The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 55 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website at hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is, Was the War in Afghanistan Worth It? And we'll now hear from Professor David S. Derizotes, who is the Director of Peace and Conflict Studies Program here at the university.
Thanks. So I'm going to be brief.
Oh, sure.
Is there a movable one?
Yes, it's right there.
This one? Is this working?
Is that working? Okay.
Whoa.
Raise your hand. We're going to take a poll at the beginning and at the end. If right now you're inclined to think, raise your hand for A, the war in Afghanistan was worth it. Raise your hand if you're inclined to think that. Okay, it's a minority. Raise your hand.
We've got quite a burden on this side right here.
Raise your hand, B,
we're okay with that.
If you're inclined to think it was not worth it. Okay, and then C, sort of neither at this point, sort of in the middle.
Stretch out a little bit.
Okay. So
David, we rest our case.
Yeah. You can't do any better than that.
That means we get double time.
We're going to measure to see if it changed.
But you can take triple time.
So we're scientists, right? So I'm here to thank our sponsors really quick. The College of Law, Tanner Center for Nonviolent Human Rights, the Vet Center, John Park Debate Society, Department of Political Science, and Hinckley Institute. And again, it's the program of peace and conflict studies that is promoting this. We hope to continue to have a relationship with our vets as we study peace and conflict. So I think our moderator is late, so what I want to do until he gets here is ask the panelists to introduce yourselves, and then and after you do that, maybe we'll start with your initial comments, okay, in any order you want. Please try to be nonviolent.
I'll start, since I'm the lowest ranking person on this panel in every possible way.
It's a hard statement.
I'm a member of the Utah National Guard, and I was recently deployed to Afghanistan, so I was in the final rotation of Operation Enduring Freedom. Got back recently in this past December. But in my academic life, I'm a PhD candidate in the Department of Communication here at the University of Utah, and I work for Dr. Derizotes in the Peace and Conflict Studies program. And I think I'll leave it at that, and I'll let Major Matt Cavanaugh introduce himself.
And your name is?
My name is Rich Stoll. Thank you. That's probably the most important part of the introduction.
I'm there for you, Rich.
So, Major Matt Cavanaugh, I teach military strategy at West Point. I'm an Army strategist, which sounds like I said magician, but it just means I'm a senior staff officer. Everything I say, you ought to know that I'm not wearing a uniform today purposefully, because you ought to know that everything I say is my view alone, not the views of West Point, not the views of the United States Army or the government in any form or fashion. I just think this is a terribly important discussion and a dialogue between citizens like you and folks with shorter haircuts like us up here. And then beyond that, too, you ought to know my office mate, he's a Special Forces officer and a Duke grad. And really excited. Well, you know, when I told him I was going to be in Utah the day before the game and I'm going to be here tomorrow for a little bit, too, he looked me right in the eye and he said, I want you to punch every single person you see in the face. And I said, you know, I'm going to a debate. Like, I'm trying to persuade not to pummel anybody. But by the end of this time, you'll want to pummel the Taliban more than anything.
Is this how you guys put hearts and minds?
Yeah.
Have we started?
Very violent folks, so I'll turn it over to Professor
Giora. My name is Amos Giora. I'm a professor of law at the S.J. Quinney College of Law. I served for 20 years in the Israel Defense Forces, and it's a pleasure to be here.
My name is Roger Perkins. I'm the director of the Veterans Support Center here on campus. I did 21 years in the Army. My last job was during Desert Storm. I was the G2 of Army Special Forces Command, and we developed intelligence operations and plans and supported that. And I'm glad to be here as well.
So would the panelists begin by making an initial statement, something under 3.0 minutes?
Go ahead.
I bow to your magnificence. Go right ahead.
So we're in the uncomfortable position that we can only screw this thing up because all of you agree with us.
Yeah.
When I think about Afghanistan, then today and trying to project what the future is. First of all, the title that you chose, was Afghanistan effective or failure, is, I think in retrospect, it should be is, not was, because given the president's decision on Tuesday to slow down the withdrawal of American forces and to keep 9,300 American forces in Afghanistan, from my perspective, for reasons that are absolutely and totally unclear, for me, just proves the point. If you don't know why you're there, you don't know why you went in the first place. So I understand all the rhetoric. I get the rhetoric. I served for 20 years in the IDF, so I can, you know, I can do the mantras. But at the end of the day, from my perspective, the role of the president, or whichever president, not important, which president, when he decides to put young people in harm's way, he needs to be in a position to be able to explain to their parents why he put them in harm's way. And when soldiers come home in a box, pardon my intimacy, but when soldiers come home in a box, hello, Kirk. This is Kirk Jowers. I'm your introducer. When soldiers come home in a box, the president of the United States must be able to explain to their loved ones why he put them in harm's way in the first place. And in doing so, he must do so devoid of mantra, devoid of cliches, and devoid of that vague and amorphous blah, blah that we fall privy to. And I think that both President Bush and President Obama would be hard-pressed to look a parent in the eye and give them a real reason why they put young people in harm's way. Then and today, I'm looking forward, and therefore for that reason, I find this conflict both to be ineffective, unnecessary, and projecting forward, I see it as a black hole.
What he said. No. Actually, not what he said. If I may, how many of you were actually alive when John Kennedy was president? Okay. I'm basing my position on something he said in his inaugural address. He said, let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe to assure the survival and the success of liberty. He didn't say we'd do all that unless it took too long or cost too much. And this is one thing Amos and I do agree on quite a bit. If you're going to send our young men and women into a war, into a conflict of any kind, you need to be able to stay there long enough to get the results you want at the end. Currently in Afghanistan, pardon me for reading, the GDP has risen to more than $20 billion. That's five times what they had in 2002. They've got 104. They started out with 148 targeted health facilities. They now have 432. The 25% of those before we got there were for women specifically. Now 74% are. These are all great things. These are great strides that are brought about by the presence of the United States and NATO in Afghanistan. They can't do this on their own. If we're going to go in and make a promise to these people, whether it's the Afghans or the Iraqis or the Vietnamese or whoever we're dealing with, and say we're going to come there because we're the United States and we're going to help you become a better, safer place, and then pull out halfway through, that is morally reprehensible. And John Kennedy understood that. And as soon as the further away we get from a president that will take a moral position, whoever that president is, the easier it seems to be to turn our back on the moral imperative. Wars are going to happen. We're all soldiers. At least most of us are professional soldiers. Fighting is something that's going to happen in the world. Like it or not, it's going to happen. But if we're going to do it, let's do it for the right reasons, and let's finish what we start. Otherwise, we are wasting money, and we are wasting lives. And at the risk of sounding overly patriotic, that is simply not the American way. Thank you.
You mentioned the right reasons. I'll start with September 11th, because if we're going to start a discussion about this war, that's where we should start, which is then. 2,700 Americans, 300 of the world's citizens died that day. And when you turn on the news and you see that ISIS has executed another individual person, just remember that this is exponentially greater damage than ISIS has caused so far. The U.S. Congress voted 420-1 to do this military action, 98-0 in the Senate. When do we get that unanimity? NATO invoked Article 5 for the first time in the organization's history. Vladimir Putin signed up. The United Nations Security Council resolution endorsed the war, and pretty much every just war scholar that there is, to include Michael Walzer, said that this was a moral action. So when we actually got there in October and November of 2001, Kabul resembled Germany at the end of the Second World War, frankly. A third of the population had left. 10% of the population had been killed after 20 years of war. It was pretty much literally the worst country on the planet. So strike and go, just hit them, knock them out of Kabul, and then move on, just was never going to work. Why would you destroy a safe haven just to create a Texas-sized power vacuum? Literally, it's the size of the state of Texas. So as far as reasons go, our interests were vital. They're security reasons. A massive attack was perpetrated from Afghanistan on the United States. So, I mean, there's no more grave threat than that. Geostrategic. Afghanistan sits right next to Pakistan, and they share a 1,600-mile border, a mountainous border that, you know, is virtually ungovernable. You know, when you take a look at that, the Wasatch Range is 160 miles. This is 10 times larger. And so it's very easy for instability in Afghanistan to bleed over into Pakistan, and Pakistan has 120 nuclear weapons. So there's a second reason. And then the third is humanitarian. To deny the Taliban essentially gender apartheid and then cultural cleansing. They were blowing up Buddhas in Bamiyan before ISIS was destroying the museums of Mosul. So this is ISIS before ISIS was there. As far as strategic value, what did you get out of this conflict? What was gained out of this conflict? First, Al-Qaeda is no more. Their last successful strike on the Western world was in July of 2005 against London. They had perpetrated attacks against multiple U.S. embassies. They bombed the USS Cole. And then again, the largest mass murder in history, effectively. The Taliban has been toppled. They only matter still in that country in the places that don't matter. So Osama bin Laden is dead. It's never worth it to dance on somebody's grave, but I know everybody here is sort of fine with that, frankly. Pakistan is safe and more secure from instability in Afghanistan. And frankly, as far as global position goes, ours is slightly better because now we have at least a strong ally, I would suggest, in Kabul, which is debatable, but that's why we're here. And then the costs. 2,200 soldiers. A soldier's life is invaluable to their family members and valuable to the nation. And although it's never worth a soldier's life to that family, ever, I have two younger brothers that are in the Army, it is sometimes worth it for national security. Particularly 2,200 soldiers, when you compare that to the 500,000 vehicle deaths we've had in this country in the last decade, or the 100,000 gun deaths, it's actually a reasonable price, I would suggest. $850 billion, that's a lot of money. But it sounds high because our GDP is so high. So during the Second World War, we were spending 35% of our GDP on the military, 9% in Vietnam, and we've stayed roughly at about 4% for the last decade. The reason you haven't seen people protesting in the streets, frankly, is because it's been so cheap, so to speak. I hate to put it that way. But frankly, the cost has been manageable.
And sorry to cut you off, but I want to make sure that you don't lose everything right off the bat. You got to save some of your ammo, and I think the initial agreement here, and then I'll explain my absence in about 3 minutes.
Can I finish one
finish
last
one
point?
Sentence, yeah, yeah. Then we'll go on.
So
yeah.
They're going to focus on those costs, but you have to ask them, and that's going to be your job too, what was the price for inaction? What was the alternate course? What could we have done otherwise, and how was that better? So don't let them leave without answering that question. Rich.
I would only add to that, you know, I agree with everything that Matt said, and I would also agree with something that Professor Giora said, which was, you know, we shouldn't let our politicians get away with explaining this war using mantras and cliches. And, you know, I think they've done that to some extent, and that's part of the problem. That's partly why I think so many of you raised your hands to indicate that you didn't think that the war was worth it, because it hasn't really been explained. I think our political class has tried to run away from it, quite frankly, and they haven't explained to us the moral imperative that we had to go in there in the first place and to sustain the efforts there to build a viable state. And so I would only add that the reasons given to us initially for invading Afghanistan were quite clear. We had two goals, and those goals have not really changed in 13 years. They were first to Depose the Taliban and eliminate al-Qaeda as a credible threat to the United States, to the homeland, and more broadly, to prevent Afghanistan from ever becoming a sanctuary for terror groups like al-Qaeda. And it's undeniable that we've achieved those goals. It has taken 13 years. It's cost $850 billion, roughly, and it's cost the lives of more than 2,000 American servicemen and men and women, and nearly 4,000 total of our allies. But the Taliban is nowhere near constituted like it was 10 years ago. I mean, there's just nobody can credibly say that the Taliban is anywhere near taking control of that country. There's a fairly firm democratic government in possession of Afghanistan. The president of Afghanistan spoke to our Congress jointly 2 days ago, and he made quite an impassioned case for our continuing to be involved there. And al-Qaeda, like Major Kavanaugh said, al-Qaeda is decimated. We don't talk about al-Qaeda these days at all. And so I would argue that the rationale have always been clear. We've achieved it, but our political leaders have not done a very good job explaining to us what we've gotten from our investment in Afghanistan.
All right, thanks. So thank you, everyone. I apologize for being late. My calendar said 2 p.m., and I had an obligation with Governor Herbert on some legislative things, and so I thought I was 3 minutes early, but so I'm sorry that there was a miscommunication. That's not your fault, but we're in good shape. Your panelists have been introduced. I hope it did them justice. They are well qualified to have this debate, and it is intended as a debate more than a discussion. I want to thank everyone who was thanked, and won't go back to that, but I do want to particularly thank Rich Stoll, who has been kind of the single biggest force for good on bringing these different groups together and the panelists together and helping us get some structure on it. So thank you, Rich, and thank you everyone else who has been thanked, who richly deserved it. The question, of course, that we're going to try to get to, and you got the glimpse, you saw the trailer, was the war in Afghanistan worth it? And let me begin, so to speak, with a brief background, and then I'll mostly turn it back to our esteemed panelists and let them go at it. But for them, what they're talking about, and I heard 7 or 8 buzzwords, they know it so deeply that they just, you know, they know what they feel. So let me give you a little bit of a background, hopefully as unimpassioned and as objective as possible, of just some key facts that got us up to this point, to where we now have the chance to reassess, was the Afghanistan war worth it? And they will make their cases, and hopefully at the end of this, our goal is that you will have a better feeling yourself on that question. In October 2001, the U.S. led an international military coalition in Afghanistan to overthrow the Taliban regime in response to the attacks of 9/11. On October 7th, 2001, Allied airstrikes bombarded Taliban and al-Qaeda targets. On the ground, American, British, and other Allied special forces worked with the Northern Alliance to begin a military offensive to take control of that country. These attacks led to the fall of Kabul on November 13, 2001, as the Taliban retreated from most of northern Afghanistan. By December of that year, American Army units partnered with Hamid Karzai in southern Afghanistan, took the Taliban capital of Kandahar, and quickly established an air base there. As more Allied troops entered the war and the Northern Alliance forces fought their way southward, the Taliban and al-Qaeda retreated toward the mountainous border region between Afghanistan and Pakistan. You heard a little bit about what that region is and how difficult it is. You'll hear more. From 2002 onward, the Taliban focused on survival and on rebuilding its forces. By most observers and most measurements, Operation Enduring Freedom was deemed a success, at least initially. It had accomplished its goals. Things seemed to be moving in the right direction. Certainly trouble signs, moving in the right direction. Early on, coalition political leaders met in Germany, where they approved the Bonn Accords and backed an interim government led by Karzai. In 2004, see, we're skipping fast, starting in 2001, we're already at 2004, President Karzai publicly announced the constitution of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan, the culmination of a 2-year deliberative process that many stable Western democracies might envy in its dream state. Karzai was chosen as a constitutional president by way of national elections. In 2005, there were 66,000 Afghan security forces and approximately 35,000 coalition forces. The world hoped that Afghanistan was approaching stability and independence. Hope. But by 2006, the Taliban had regrouped and appeared to threaten the fragile government. When President Obama took office in 2009, U.S. military leaders were asking for more resources to prosecute the war. Something had gone awry. The same feelings of hope had begun to diminish, and there was a great argument about what should be done next, but a troop surge was approved, and in 2010, 100,000 Americans were serving in Afghanistan. By the time Operation Enduring Freedom concluded this past December, the U.S. had spent at least $686 billion in that country. A study conducted by Brown University estimated that the Afghanistan war will cost $2.2 trillion when the residual costs, such as for veterans' health care and other related costs, are factored in. Most sobering, and you heard these numbers, over the course of the 13-year war, around 2,000 Americans have been killed in combat, almost 3,000 coalition forces. And in spite of these sacrifices, the Taliban insurgency rages on, and Afghanistan remains a failed state in a seemingly perpetual civil war. That's the hopefully quick background, and the question we get to is, was it worth it? And the terms of the debate are to go to two topics and to look at them quite thoroughly. One is the moral dimension. It sounded like some of these, the first three openings had something to do with that. To keep it simple, Matt and Rich believe the war was worth it. It's more nuanced, and you'll hear that. Amos and Roger do not. And so we will turn to these two teams to debate these topics. The two topics are, the first one will be the moral dimension, and the second one will be the strategic dimension. Because we're going a little bit behind, we were going to start with five-minute openings by the team, but we'll kind of cut that down to about 3 minutes. You can get that done in a minute and a half opening. Each team will have an opening. Each team will have a rebuttal, and then each team will have a close, and I'll fill in where necessary, but basically it'll just be the teams kind of working this through. So we'll start with team Matt and Rich to argue the moral dimension.
Well, so I think we've touched on a lot of these issues, but I want to focus more thoroughly on the brutality of the Taliban regime in the late 90s up through 2001. It's almost cliche now to throw about the word Taliban. It's almost like using the word Nazi in our political parlance. But this was a real governing regime that took control of Afghanistan in the mid-90s. And they were absolutely brutal. Imagine the worst headlines that you read about ISIS these days. And this was the common practice, the governing practice of the regime in Afghanistan for 6 or 7 years. Public executions of political prisoners, just brutal treatment of women and children and orphans. And I think by that measure alone, the international community was called upon to intervene, just to save these poor people in Afghanistan who had been through decades of war and now had to suffer under Taliban rule. These are the same people who shot the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, Malala Yousafzai, a 15-year-old girl for promoting girls' education in Afghanistan and Pakistan. These are the people who would go and they threatened voters on election day, and in several provinces they went and cut off the fingers, the famous inked fingers of people who had dared to vote in a democratic election. This is the government. This is the alternative that we could have left in place in 2001 had we not invaded. And I don't think there's really any debate about whether or not we should have invaded. There wasn't much debate at the time, at least. I think the issue now is, having looked back on the 13 years, was it worth it? And I think morally it was, if for nothing more than to rid a country of a despotic regime like the Taliban.
Anything else? If not, then we'll go to Team Amos.
Team Amos.
Amos and Roger.
Okay, so, which makes interesting and important points, which is a polite way of saying that I disagree with everything he said. If we follow the argument to its logical conclusion, then that would mean that the U.S., by the end of the day today, needs to be, let's count the countries, North Korea, Iran, and the list goes on and on. So the idea that we are, the United States, is the world's protector of all humanitarian violations of human rights is an argument that, from my perspective, while I understand it and respect it, is one that I fundamentally disagree with. And you can make the same argument then with respect to Syria, which is also a god-awful regime, and there we've obviously stayed up. One of the really difficult questions for a superpower like the United States is you got to pick your battles carefully. And not only do you have to pick your battles carefully, but you have to Kirk's term, you have to be able to define morality, and you also have to define effectiveness, and you also have to define the limits of power. And so every time we see some god-awful regime, and these are all awful regimes, violating the human rights of its citizens, I'm not convinced, have never been convinced, and will not be convinced, that it's the role of the United States to always be the savior of human rights wherever. I think it's a burden that, with all due respect to Kennedy's inaugural address, it's a burden that I think the United States need not impose on itself, because the problem with imposing that burden on yourself with all those highfalutin words is at the end of the day, you put young people in harm's way. And if I just make one last point, Matt makes the point that there have been no demonstrations on the streets of America and on college campuses. Most of you are way too young. I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where everybody was demonstrating against the war in Vietnam. The reason that there are no demonstrations in the country and on college campuses today is there's no draft. And the truth of the matter is, A, there's no draft, and B, and I don't mean this disrespectfully because all of you are here today, but I spend a lot of time speaking on these issues both to military people like Matt and to others. The truth of the matter is the public is largely and ultimately totally disengaged from what's going on in Afghanistan. And the fact that the public is disengaged, they see the names, they say the numbers, but you know what? There's a game tonight between Duke and Utah. There are things that are far more pressing. So on the one hand, we make this moral argument that at some point gets drowned out, and the fact there is no draft, the public is largely and totally, and I shouldn't say totally, largely disengaged from the conflict in Iraq, Afghanistan, ISIS is next, and it just at some point it becomes too much. And I think for that reason, there's been absolutely silence on the public front.
Thank you. Let's go back to the 3-minute rebuttal now with Matt and Rich.
So, not our responsibility, sure, but it's in our interest. It's clearly in our security interest. Not every country has been a base of support for an attack on the U.S. homeland. Not every country is sitting right next to the world's least stable nuclear power. I mean, these are true. These are facts. So there is a strategic interest for us getting involved in Afghanistan. That's not true everywhere. But while you have strategic interests, you have humanitarian ones as well. So I raised the question a moment ago that our opponents have the burden of describing a world, that an alternative world, sort of the better way that we could have taken and how it would have been better. But luckily, I don't have the burden of imagination. I don't need fiction or fantasy. Rich just brought this up. We have the Taliban. So if you knock them down in sort of a tactical strike that feels good, but as soon as you leave, they come right back in. They fill the vacuum. Mullah Omar and the Taliban's Afghanistan provided no access to care for the average citizen. The average person lived to 45 years old. Nowadays, 10 years later, the average citizen of Afghanistan lives to 64. That's the equivalent of all of you as American citizens going from 82 to 110 for the average lifespan. I mean, that's an amazing growth. Part of that is because women had no access to medical care. I mean, I use the term gender apartheid. This is very true. 80% of women went into forced marriages. For a girl, and I have two daughters, no school past the age of 8. Women were prisoners in their own homes. And in one study, and you know, you have to quite, I'm sure they're going to question this study, but 97% of women within the Taliban's sphere of control said that they would have been assessed as clinically depressed. And as far as punishments go for stepping outside of those boundaries, I don't have the time or the stomach to describe. So, you know, beyond that, the sort of systematic destruction of the world's heritage, I mentioned cultural cleansing. Taliban rule was an insult to humanity and the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. And then beyond that, it made the world significantly less secure. So if Amos and Roger think this was an acceptable price for peace, then I don't agree.
Yeah, Roger and Amos, please.
What we've been talking about so far, if I'm understanding what everybody's saying, is why we should have gone in the first place. And I don't disagree with anything you've said. But the question of the debate isn't why we should have gone in. The question was the end result worth it? Not how we started. Even the UN admits that the Taliban in 2011 was responsible for 80% of the deaths in Afghanistan. They're bad people, and quite frankly, I have no problem if they do all die. They are evil things. I understand that. But at the end of the day, if we are not willing as a state to finish that job, to remove the threat of the Taliban, not just from Afghanistan, but from across the border into Pakistan, because borders are kind of fluid things in that part of the world. It's not like driving from here to Idaho with a sign that says, "Welcome to Idaho." These are things that are fluid. They're tribal lands. They're not a developed state like we see it here. If we're not willing to leave a place here that is politically stable, that is economically stable, because these are the promises, both real and tacit, that we made. If we're not ready to do that, then we don't need to be going in. And this speaks back to who we elect as our leaders and how we do our strategic planning. When you vote for a president, or you vote for a governor, or anybody else you vote for, you need to look at how that individual is going to do their job. And if there's any question that they're not going to be able to finish something they start, you need to wonder whether you should be really putting your vote there. 80% of the money that was spent in Afghanistan was spent by Obama's administration, which I think is good. But if we leave and the Taliban or something Taliban-like comes back, then what was the point? Also, as this discussion has shown, the threat isn't strictly confined to Afghanistan. The threat of Taliban or Al-Qaeda or Boko Haram or ISIS, this is a global thing. And it's all well and good to say that the United States does not have a responsibility to do something in that. But the reality is we do. We are unique among states. We're the only country in the world that cannot trace its history back to a single tribal or two tribal groups. We are a mess. And if you heard Bono talk about the U.S., we were the first ones to come out and raise that banner of independence and liberty. Kennedy spoke of it. So if we're not willing to back it up with whatever money it takes, what are we? We're European. Because they can go in and they can go out. They've done it as a, I'm getting there. As empires, European nations were able to be a lot more flexible in how they approached geopolitical issues and conflict and war. They were able to go into some place and fight wars of attrition where they just maintain the status quo.
You got 15 seconds to
yes,
finish.
Yes, we tried that in Vietnam. It didn't work. If we're going to do this, if we're going to stand up as a nation and make these claims to be a big nation, we need to be able to back it up. If not, we need to shut up.
So, you know, when we think of whether something was worth doing something else, was worth the cost that we pay, you know, we have to, I think of it in material terms. So, for example, if I get a great deal on a house and I fix it up and I improve the value of that house, and then I sell it to the next person, and that next person lets it fall into disrepair, and it becomes worthless as a house, that doesn't mean that my initial investment was not worth it. It means that somebody didn't take the time and the resources to put the care into to maintaining that investment. I think we have, you know, this is certainly not an argument that we've done everything perfectly in Afghanistan. There's been a lot of wasted money. I think every single American NATO military casualty has been a tragedy, and I really feel for those families who have lost their soldiers and their Marines and their airmen. but we've built something that has the potential to last. And to and Afghanistan has the potential to be a long-standing, friendly nation, an ally of ours. I don't know if anybody even knew that President Ghani was speaking to Congress the other day, but I would encourage all of you to at least go read the transcript. He said thank you. Many, you know, people in America, they don't realize how much the intervention has meant to us, but you've given the people of Afghanistan hope. We've lived with war for decades and decades, and you've brought us peace, and we appreciate that, and thank you. And he thanked the taxpayer, and it was a very impassioned argument. So this is not an argument that we've done everything perfectly, and it's certainly not an argument that we need to intervene everywhere that there are moral challenges. But the moral case for us intervening in Afghanistan in 2001 was so overwhelming, so compelling, and it also happened to intersect with our vital national security interests because of the reasons that Major Kavanaugh outlined. So I would say it has been worth it. We might screw it up down the road. You know, we screwed a lot of things up back. We're pretty good at grasping defeat from the jaws of victory, as they say. But that's not an argument in support of it not having been worth it in the first place.
Thank you, Roger and Amos. You've got the final 2 minute on this one, and then I get to have some fun.
So I think the truth of the matter is, with all due respect to the moral argument, when the United States goes into Afghanistan in the aftermath of 9/11, the question wasn't one of morality. What was not driving us was the fact that the Taliban was a god-awful regime. I mean, they are the worst of the worst, like ISIS. But that's not what drove President Bush. We need to call it what it is. President Bush went into Afghanistan in the context of the authorization to use military force in direct response to 9/11. That's why we went to Afghanistan. It's got nothing to do with morality. So you go in, and then you decide to take out the Taliban. Okay. 13 years later, the question of morality, from my perspective, the arguments, and you're right, Matt, to raise this, the improvement of women's lives and education, so on, all true. Absolutely 100% true. But the question from a moral geopolitical question, if that really A, is the responsibility of the United States, and B, if that's what drove the United States initially, it did not, and C, whether indeed it should be determined in terms of continued American presence, and D, at the end of the day, how do you get to our question, how do you define effectiveness? To define effectiveness, you have to circle your way all the way back to ask why you initially went in. The only reason the United States went into Afghanistan was because of 9/11. It had zero to do with morality. Then you ask yourself, okay, did we defeat the Taliban? If the answer is yes, then you can say the answer then is yes, that was effective. But anything thereafter raises significant questions about why are you still there, and raises really important questions about the long-term effectiveness. I would define effectiveness short-term, long-term. Short-term, I understand it. Long-term, I don't. And one more point, then I'll stop, is I would suggest never bet your last dollar because you got to feed your kids. My second to last dollar, I make the following suggestion. There is no country called Afghanistan. It's a fiction. Mm-hmm. There's no country called Iraq. These are nothing more than a collection of tribes. And for us to talk about Afghanistan as if it's some Western country, it's not. It's a collection of tribes. And that moment the United States will come out and leave Afghanistan, my suggestion, I refer back to Churchill, said no foreign power has ever successfully invaded and conquered Afghanistan. When the United States will leave Afghanistan, what Afghanistan was is what Afghanistan will be. And for us to suggest we've created some new power, you know, it's going to be friendly to the United States, will be European-like, it's an absolutely fundamental intellectual and practical misnomer.
Thanks. So there's a fascinating debate between the two teams. I've been friends with Amos for a long time. I think I could play poker against him now because I know his facial expressions and body language. And it seems to me there might be a little bit of tension within Team Roger Amos. What I took from Roger on his rebuttal was it's not how it started, but how it ended. And essentially, if we are not willing to leave it stable, then we should not go in. One way to interpret that is we should pony up again. We should go in harder, stronger. And we did whatever we did. We didn't fix it. Now everyone seemed to kind of agree. We've done good things. There was some agreement there, but Afghanistan is not Germany right now. And so Roger, are you saying? It's the logical extension. You said, what was the point? Is the point now that U.S. has a moral imperative to double down, to take those thank yous that we received yesterday and really try to improve Afghanistan, or is that not where your point was going?
Everything we're talking about is far more complicated than what we're discussing. Life is complicated. So no, that doesn't mean we need to send more troops back into Afghanistan and double down on it. We're leaving 10,000 troops in there right now. It's a little bit short of a division. It'll be spread out between special operations forces and support people. I think what we need to do now, and I say this now, I kind of got stuck in a spot here because they're leaving more troops there than they said they were, so it kind of undercuts my argument. But if we're going to stay to get the result that we want, we need to put our effort and our ability, first of all, into something that isn't going to be 3 or 4 years long. We're talking about an effort that's going to be 20 or 30 or 40 years long. Because Amos is absolutely right. We're talking about a fundamental cultural shift. You're taking people from the 17th century and trying to bring them into the 20th century. Not the 21st, just the 20th. At least as far as they handle their culture, handle their politics, and deal with their neighbors and deal with their internal efforts. They're not going to be European. They're going to be Afghan. They're not going to judge things, to do things the way we do. And that's not the goal. But if they can do things effectively and not be, well, let's cut it short, what they were before, that's a win. But it's not, so, and we can influence them. We have the opportunity to do that. But not if we gauge everything by how much it costs and how long it takes. I submit that for U.S. foreign policy, the moral imperative is a big part of it. Everybody says we went into Desert Storm because of oil. It's just, there's one reason we go to war. There are a million reasons why the U.S. engages in warfare. And from my experience, oil was the third thing on the list. And we'd be fools not to notice it. With Afghanistan, the moral imperative is on the list as well. Getting rid of the Taliban is there. Making sure that there is not a stronghold for other groups is there. Ensuring that Pakistan is safe, or at least safer, which we have not done a good job on, because this is sloughed over into Pakistan. So if we're going to get the result we want, with the 10,000 people we've got left there, use them wisely. Make them special ops forces. Make this a foreign internal development mission, which is something special forces does. And build that strong governmental presence, and bring about that cultural and perspective shift in the bulk of the population of Afghanistan, where they can accept the first step down the road to both stability and a political system that is more democratic, not completely, than what they had before. Does that answer your question?
Mostly. So that I don't ruin anything from the next one, which is the strategic dimension. And Matt, I thought, nicely parlayed what seemed like an easy kill, and Amos took it nicely, was...
That means he killed me?
He didn't kill you. Okay. But he took out some steam in the argument of... Everyone agreed Taliban were bad guys. They did bad things. God-awful regime was a quote from Amos, for example. So there's a moral imperative to fight evil. And Matt didn't necessarily back away from... Amos didn't back away from that, but he just simply said, you know, where does the U.S. responsibility end? Well, shouldn't they be in Nigeria and Syria and North Korea? And I mean, it goes on forever. Matt's rebuttal was not our responsibility, so you take that out. It wasn't our responsibility. That means we don't have to go to Nigeria, perhaps, under that one, but it's our strategic interest. So that does bleed to strategic dimension, so I'm not going to ask those follow-up questions yet. I'll let you do it in the format we have. So, but to get a little bit of closure, let me ask two quick questions. These are less than a sentence, maybe even word answers from each of you. One, the question is, was it worth it? But part of whether it's worth it, you've all kind of demonstrated, is how it ends. We are at a stopping point. You may have all agreed in 2003 that it was worth it at that point. So the first question is, should the U.S. at this point dramatically increase, is one answer, increase, we're right where we should be, decrease or dramatically decrease its commitment, both, and that would be everything, commitments, resources, troops, whatever, at this moment going forward? Don't explain yourself. Just give me one of those five answers. You'll get a chance to explain yourself in strategic convention if you want to. Start with you, Rich, and come toward me.
I think we're pretty close to where we ought to be, and I think we measure it based on what the government of Afghanistan has asked for.
Okay. It's a radio audience.
Stay on the path. We're on the right track. We're on
the right track. Right path?
Out.
Completely out.
Out.
Okay.
I can't do it one line. Out.
You're going to have to.
Out.
Even though you can take
it. Finish it right.
Say that again, sorry.
Out if we're not going to finish it right.
Well, then which would you choose? If you have complete power, you want to finish it right or get out, which do you choose out of those two?
I'd finish it right. I'd stay.
So that's a dramatically increase is the answer, right?
No, not necessarily.
All right. Okay, we'll get back to
that. He doesn't have confidence that we could ever finish anything right.
So that goes back to why we started, and that's not the focus of this debate. Okay. So hopefully that's crystal clear for everyone.
Kirk, you have your next debate here. Yeah. You have the next debate lined up.
That's true. 3 to 4, stick around. But without further ado, let's go to strategic dimension. It's going to follow the same format you just saw, except that we're going to start with Team Roger and Amos with a combined 5-minute opening, however they decide to break it up, and we'll go from there.
Strategy is a different thing to discuss because you want to try and simplify things. And strategy is not simple. Strategy is where you fight and why you fight. How you fight is tactics. So when you talk about strategy, and because of the nature of the thing here, you can't go into a Command General Staff College lecture on what constitutes strategy. There's a lot of things that go into it. And I'll go back to my basic argument. There are things that have to be done from a strategic perspective if we're going to come to an end point in Afghanistan and be successful there. So far, the reasons we fought haven't been, as has been pointed out, have not been clearly explained. We're not sure what our long-term goals are. We've got the capacity to develop those long-term goals. This is not something the U.S. has started out new. We know how to strategize. We know how to set down a plan. We know how to do long-term thinking. We've got a whole big chunk of the government that makes their living doing that stuff. What we've done is not use it, which again goes back to intent. If you're going to go in there, do it right. Most of us, I think, have been through a variety of schools that teach us how to plan operations. You always plan with the objective in mind. If you don't know what the objective is, what are you doing? You're fighting a war of attrition. You're staying there and see how it turns out. Doesn't work out well for the U.S. Some countries can do that. We cannot. If we cannot identify what our strategic goals are, and if those strategic goals do not include something that is in the best overall interest of the United States, regionally, if not globally, then there's no reason to stay.
Amos, you want to finish off?
Yeah, just a couple points. There's a theory out there called unwinnable wars. And I would suggest that this conflict is an unwinnable war. And I hate to put on my legal hat because that's an incredibly boring hat.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I apologize in advance.
But you will.
But I will. When international law was created back in the 16th century when I was in law school, the conflict was called war between states, and war can only be between states. And I'm hard-pressed to believe that Afghanistan really is a state, and we didn't go fight Afghanistan. We went to fight the Taliban, who are not a state. They're a non-state actor. And we're engaged in a conflict, not a war, with a non-state actor. And if I analogize to my Israeli experience, the years that I spent serving in the IDF, you're never going to defeat a terrorist organization. You're never going to defeat a non-state actor. So in the context of ISIS, because Matt draws us into the ISIS discussion, geopolitically and strategically speaking, I take you back to August of this past year when President Obama said we were going to degrade and destroy ISIS. So I have no idea what it means to destroy a terrorist organization. I don't believe you can destroy a terrorist organization, nor do I believe you can degrade an idea. So in the context of geopolitical thinking and strategic thinking, when we went into Afghanistan to fight the Taliban, yes, we've said it earlier that I think most of us agree that it made sense then. But if you think geopolitically in this context of unwinnable war, at some point, and I apologize for the terminology, you've got to cut your losses and say, we're done here, because you know there are going to be other battles down the road, and you have to be able to pick and choose your battles geopolitically and geostrategically in a very Machiavellian sense, absolutely devoid of this concept of morality and doing the right thing. There's a limit to doing the right thing. We've got what we've lost here is in any sense of an articulated geopolitical strategic thinking, and from my perspective, that in as many ways is why Afghanistan, for me, is a lose-lose.
All right, thank you.
So I would just say very quickly that it's not an unwinnable war objectively because we won. The Taliban is not in power. There's a friendly democratic government that has a tenuous hold, but a hold on territory, a giant piece of territory. I would argue the Taliban was a state actor. They held territory, and now the duly elected democratic government of Afghanistan holds that territory. And how many friends do we have as from the United States? How many friends do we have in that part of the world? True friends. Well, Afghanistan is an ally right now, and we ought to nurture that. And not only their government, but their citizens went out and cast votes for the United States. That's what they did last year. They voted for the candidate that was most pro-U.S. And it was a referendum on U.S. policies as much as anything else. And we ought to nurture that alliance.
Okay. As far as Winston Churchill and whether or not anyone ever held Afghanistan, he's forgetting the Persians. Actually, the suffix Stan is Persian for place. So it was place of the Afghans because they were ruled by the Persians for so long. We were never seeking democracy as it is practiced in the Western world in Afghanistan. This was never going to be Denmark. It was to preserve Afghanistan and purge the Taliban. As far as not being able to defeat the Taliban and them being a non-state actor, actually, the Hinckley Institute is a non-state actor, too. But
we can't be beat.
Yeah. But when they have a 1,600-mile sanctuary, 10 times larger than the Wasatch Front, they were always going to be able to retreat to the hills. Mullah Omar lives in Pakistan. He has not been able to return home. They are irrelevant. They've been marginalized. And there's no better way to ensure that they don't, you know, if you live under the Taliban regime, you don't want them. They're actually less popular in Afghanistan than the U.S. Congress is, which is saying something, actually. This is hard, but it has not. So when the war began, the United States had about 25% of global domestic product, the world's GDP. We have about 25% now. We were spending about 40% of what the world spends on military spending then. We spend about 40% on it now. We haven't seen ally abandonments. Although we were a little bit worried, we're a little worried about the Israelis right now. You know, in fact, we've even grown one in Afghanistan. As far as strike and go, you know, which is I think maybe the other course other than sort of a full-fledged war, the quickest way to end a war is to lose it, as George Orwell put it. And if you just topple the Taliban, if you just take a very narrow view of it, just respond in kind from the 9/11 attack, then new wars ignite on the embers of the last fight. And what matters is who you leave in place to guard those embers. Do you leave a fireman or do you leave an arsonist? And leaving a vacuum there was never an option, frankly. Sometimes war is the least bad option. It's never ideal. It's never a first choice, but it's the least bad option. And frankly, right now, where we find ourselves, we're on a sustainable path. President Ghani, this is something he said, tragedy brought us together. Interests now unite us. He spent 15 years working at the World Bank. He's got a PhD from Columbia in anthropology. We have the right person at the helm to develop this country. That and the 350,000 Afghan national security forces we've developed since we've been there mean that this country will be secure as long as we continue to invest in them. $5 billion a year is the price tag, which is a lot of money, frankly. I bet the Hinckley Institute could probably use that. But $5 billion a year is about what we give right now to the Israelis and the Egyptians. $5 billion a year is a third of what Americans spend on bottled water every year. So we can afford this. We are on the track. And frankly, you know, this is in our interests. And this is why you should consider this effort to have been worth it and why you should support the motion.
So. Thank you. We go to the rebuttal.
So, Matt, Matt's last word is a really important word. In many ways, it drives the geopolitical discussion here. That word is interests. What worries me, 2015, as I understand from the New York Times, which never lies, there's a presidential election in 2016. And whoever is going to run, I understand there's a long list of people. Wow.
On one side.
Yeah.
It's a coronation on the other.
Kirk, let's move ahead. I think it would behoove the long list of candidates on both sides to honestly address the question, and it's a difficult one, of what are American geopolitical interests? Stripping it to its barest bones, devoid of the morality discussion, how do we define interests geopolitically throughout the world, and what are the consequences of, if you're going to Afghanistan, how does that impact Pakistan? How does that impact, for instance, Yemen? I don't know how many of you have been following it, but there's a revolution going on in Yemen. The Yemeni president is AWOL. You know, he's putting out an SOS trying to find the guy. And it goes on and on and on. One of the things that is, from my perspective, is largely missing in this entire discussion, both, I mean, not here, but the broader national discussion, is that nobody who's running for president, whichever party, dares address concisely the question of what are American interests. And if the failure to do that, I think, will all but inevitably place American servicemen and women in harm's way yet again, because what we do, because we don't define the term interest, we allow ourselves this mush wiggle room, and thereby we go from haphazardly from place to place. When I think about Afghanistan, the consequences of Afghanistan down the road, much like Vietnam, you know, 40, 50 years later, there's no clear articulated reason that explains rational-based decision-making, why we did A as compared to B, or why we did C. From my perspective, geopolitically, that is an enormous fault, and I think in terms of both President Bush and President Obama, both have absolutely failed to concisely, consistently articulate the word American interest narrowly. That, I think, is a great failing.
Thank you. Roger, you got 45 seconds. If you want to take it.
Sure. Test afterwards. I don't disagree with any of the three of these people have said. But if you don't add a moral imperative to the strategic interest of the United States, then it's not the United States. Every war that we have fought, that we've fought with a moral imperative, we've done well in. If we followed our geopolitical interest in World War II, we would never have gotten involved. The Japanese pounded us on Pearl Harbor, they had a much larger army, so did the Germans. A smart move would have been not to get involved. We got involved because we had a moral imperative. This is what makes us who we are as a nation, and that's why we're different from others as a nation. And yes, you have to think of those strategic goals that you're looking for, the geopolitical issues. Those are all there. But at some point, whoever you elect as president from whichever party has to sit down and make that call about what's good for the United States. And that's really going to be right up at the top of that list if they're good. And part of that's going to be what does America stand for? What does America do? And if what America does is follow the money, cut it if it's too hard, can't get anything out of it, don't go, then he won't, or she won't. But if that moral imperative is there, that'll be the deciding factor. Because when it comes right down to it, it's somebody sitting behind a desk in the Oval Office making the call. And all the numbers and facts and figures you can put in front of them are real good, and they help them make that call. But they're going to make that call based on morals.
Thank you. 3-minute rebuttal.
Yeah, I kind of feel like Roger's our ringer on the other team. I feel like he's making my arguments for me. As a matter of fact, for my introduction, I had John F. Kennedy's inaugural address that I was going to read, and I'm going to reiterate that.
You need to coordinate better, man.
He says, "Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, to assure the survival and the success of liberty." Now, I know that's feel-goodism, and it's politics, and you got to unite everybody and make them, you know, wave the flag on Inauguration Day. But morality, that's a case for moral interventionism. And morality is tied to our nation's security. Let's suppose that a president makes some sort of a declaration. We call it, I know I'm wading into dangerous waters here, but if the president draws a red line against a country who's using chemical weapons, let's say, and that does not follow that up, that is an invitation for insecurity. And so if we don't back up these moral statements that basically every president has echoed since John F. Kennedy, if we don't back those up, it will infringe on our security. So in many ways, morality and security intersect in geopolitics, and they certainly have that in Afghanistan.
And Matt, you have a couple of minutes if you want, but what I'm going to do is Amos is going to pull a Kirk. He's going to have to leave this place early in order to get to another place late. He's got to teach at 3 o'clock, and so I'm going to give you your two-minute close and then allow you to walk out, and these three will trash you.
That's like a walk-off shot.
You can hear the damage on the radio on KCPW Wednesday at 10 a.m. So
in 2 minutes. Well, as somebody who's been involved in decision-making over the course of 20 years with respect to the use of power, one of the things that I learned during the course of my career in the IDF is that power is alluring, but the fundamental question is, what are the consequences of using power when you don't have a clearly stated purpose for using that power? And when I think back over the course of the past 13 years, whether it's Iraq or Afghanistan and moving ahead, I well understand the response to 9/11. I get that. But the question when are the consequences of not having a fully articulated purpose, interest, for why you're using that power, at the end of the day, you're using power for the sake of using power. That has two negative consequences. One, ill-defined mission today. And two, because at the end of the day, power is limited. We, as strong as America is, there are so many different hotspots throughout the world. We have to ask ourselves, are we going to become the responder to all hotspots? And I would suggest that's a question we need to ask. And I would also suggest the answer needs to be no. And you need to very much pick and choose your battles. 13 years after going into Afghanistan, again, for what I said earlier, from this Machiavellian perspective, devoid of the humanitarian issue, but looking at the use of power narrowly, I'm a firm advocate of the limited use of power, provided you have a firm, clear, stated purpose for doing so. And if you don't, to quote myself earlier, you need to leave, and the sooner you leave, the better. One last word. Kirk, I want to thank you. Rich, I truly want to thank you for putting this together. But most importantly of all, thank you for all of you for coming out to discuss this issue. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Andy. We are very close to a close. I'm going to go back to Matt and Rich if he has any final words, and then Roger will be our
sure,
final
I don't
word.
Feel at all outnumbered. That's all right.
Yeah, now we've got you 2-1. Does that mean half of the original votes will now fall to us? Roger brought up whether or not this is worth the lives of American soldiers. So let me give you my perspective. First of all, you have to know, I don't vote. I do that because I don't feel comfortable exercising a partisan act when I am a servant to society. I serve the embodiment of the will of the American public, the commander-in-chief. I'll go wherever I'm sent. And unfortunately, this summer, that means for 1 year, I'm going to go to Korea. And I'm going to be away from my family. Now, I have a 5-month-old, and I have an approaching 4-year-old, Grace. I am the first thing Grace sees in the morning, and I'm the last thing that she sees before she goes to bed. And for me, this is going to be horrible to be away. I mean, it's going to be hard to continue to speak, but there are people in the world that want to destroy human progress. North Korea, ISIS, the Taliban, and they want to deny the world. They want to make a world that is not safe for diversity. But the best soldier I ever fought with in Iraq was a gay black man. The minister that touched my daughter's forehead was a gay Anglican priest. I fought alongside a Moroccan Muslim, and both of us would have died for Muslims of any sect. I've handed the flag to fallen families at funerals. A month ago, it was a Jewish family. 2 months before that, it was an atheist. My daughter, the one that I just mentioned, she had a seizure in December. We took her to a pediatric neurologist that looks like me, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. We didn't trust him. We got a second opinion, and we went to a Pakistani doctor who we completely trust. And then I'm Lutheran. That's my background. I'm from Minnesota. We're all Lutheran. That's it. But we plan on making our long-term home here in Utah, the home of the Mormon faith. This is worth fighting for. This is what's worth defending. This is worth being away from my family for a year, as difficult as that's going to be. And it's worth soldiers' lives. As President Obama said in Oslo, peace means responsibility. Peace entails sacrifice. The moral and strategic test that we have is what we do in the face of forces that want to deny this human progress. And that's why, frankly, this war was worth it, and why you should support the motion. So,
thank you. Roger, the final word.
I agree with everything he said, word for word. I will add that it takes the will to do so. It's very good to say it's worth something's worth fighting for. If you're not willing to fight for it, that's an important point. And if the United States is not willing to do the things it needs to do to make the war in Afghanistan worthwhile, then we should not be there. It's a question of national will. One of the phrases that you pick up from soldiers nowadays is that America's not at war, America's at the mall, the Army's at war. We're isolated from a lot of the things that go on. Less than 1% of our population is serving in the military right now. The odds of you even knowing somebody who's a soldier, a sailor, an airman, or a Coast Guardsman are pretty slim. I'm fortunate because I get them in my office every day in the veterans office. You don't know what people like him go through. You read it, but you don't know it. And they'll go through more if we're going to do this right. But if we're not going to do this, if we are not going to do this, don't send this man downrange for something that isn't going to pay off at the end. The reasons are good. I agree 100% with the reasons for doing it. But do it. If you're not, quit playing with it. Because the bottom line is, a lot of people want to go home to their kids. And there's a lot of strategic reasons to do this. But if as a nation we are not going to get behind getting the job done and get equipment, the headlines get bad, or the numbers get high, or your neighbor gets a flag or something goes on like that, if you're not willing to pay the cost, don't start the fight.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for being here. Thank you, Major Matt Kavanaugh, Rich Stoll, Professor Amos Gior, and Major Roger Perkins for being a part of this panel. Thank you for all of the sponsors and co-sponsors. This was a discussion at the Hinckley Institute of Politics about, was the Afghanistan War worth it? Thank you.